Rick Stevens, financial advisor with FRS Financial Group. Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. For more detailed information regarding any of the topics discussed on today's show, please call 719-500-8700. This is Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial. Here's your host, Rick Stevens.
Welcome in, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group. I am your host, Rick Stevens, and this is your show. Remember, if you've got questions that you would like to ask, if you've got a topic you'd like to hear on a future episode of Money Matters, you can always give us a call at 719-500-8700. You can also go online to frsfinancialgroup.com. You can click on that contact tab and you can send us some of those things you'd like to hear about. You can also inquire about setting up a time to sit down and chat, or you can shoot me an email, rstevens@frsfinancialgroup.com. We would love to hear from you. Folks, this week on Money Matters, we are in studio with Andrew Rogers. Andrew, it's been an interesting week in the financial world.
It has been. There's been a lot going on to unpack here on Money Matters.
Just a little bit. So I just thought I'd talk baseball today instead, right? Is that good? We can just totally ignore all the stuff going on in the financial world?
Sure. But really, what is going on?
You know, that's a wonderful, wonderful question. You know, what we've seen in the last, basically week, a little bit over, would actually make the late, great Slim Pickens smile, because I'm sure he would have looked at what was going on here and asked the question this way: of what in the wide, wide world of sports is going on?
Yeah.
You know, we've seen some craziness happening in the financial world, specifically in the banking industry, and there are some headlines out there that are correct, but there are also some that are, we'll just call them, a little bit dramatic, if we can.
Okay.
So one of those headlines that I want to kind of address here quickly before we really get into what's going on, what's been happening, and how does it affect us, are the multiple times I have seen that the second and third largest bank failures happened in the past week.
Wait, it didn't?
Well, the answer is sort of, right? Because that's a statistic, and as a user of statistics, right, being in the baseball world for years, I could tell you what my batting average was on Tuesdays when it was above 80 degrees and the count was 1-1,
mm-hmm.
Which was about 385, by the way. So we can break these down and make it do in, say, just about anything we want. But what it means when we hear that the second and third largest banks failed isn't that they were the actual second and third largest banks ever. They were just the second and third largest failures ever.
Okay.
So ultimately, and here's kind of that way to look at it, right? So prior to last week,
mm-hmm.
Silicon Valley Bank was actually the 14th largest bank in the country. And they had about $211 billion in customer deposits. And Signature Bank, which also was taken under the wing of the FDIC, and we'll talk again a little bit more in depth about what that looks like, they were the 21st largest bank. They had $110 billion in customer deposits. But to sort of put that in a little bit of perspective, largest bank in the country is J.P. Morgan Chase.
Okay.
And J.P. Morgan Chase houses about $3.7 trillion in deposits. So basically, it's 17 times larger than Silicon Valley Bank, 33 times larger than Signature Bank. So don't let those big, bold, second and third largest bank failure headlines confuse you. Because yes, they're big banks, right? Washington Mutual. Back in 2007, that was the largest bank to have ever failed. Mm-hmm. They had $300 billion in deposits in the bank.
So exactly who were these banks? Because as you mentioned, a lot of the headlines will make it sound like they're much bigger than it seems like they actually are.
Yeah, it's a great question. So there are three banks that we saw last week, and actually we're recording this on Wednesday. Today you get the headlines about Credit Suisse and their issues, and we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later on. But these three banks that failed, Silvergate, Silicon Valley, and Signature, are relatively small, and they are very niche-specific banks, meaning they weren't looking at the population as a whole as their ideal clients. They actually have very, very specific client bases that they served.
Okay, and assuming being, you know, Silicon Valley Bank is one, Silvergate, I imagine a lot of like the kind of tech startups, you know, the quote-unquote tech bro type sector.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, Silicon Valley Bank, the one way that it is, as we could almost call it, fundamentally different from other banks, think about small regional banks, right? Mm-hmm. The ones that don't have the Bank of America, U.S. Bank, Wells Fargo, Chase. Those are the big boys nationally. Then we've got the smaller local banks, right? Or regional banks, some that serve a particular area in the country. Silicon Valley, as the name suggests, did serve Silicon Valley, okay, right? In that big tech world. And one of the things that they actually had on their website, right? You can still go to the Silicon Valley Bank website, look it up. The way they describe themselves is this: SVB is fundamentally different than other banks. Okay, as a depositor, that should be issue number one I'm looking at, because I don't want my bank to be fundamentally different from somebody else's bank.
Yeah, I mean, you want your bank to be a bank.
Right. But they describe themselves as offering modern banking products designed for tech, life science, and healthcare founders. Really, what they were the bank that a lot of what are called venture capitalists, right? The folks who basically front money mm-hmm. for a company to get started, they were the bank that money flowed through. And in fact, they actually had fairly recently, in fact, had said that they basically were the bank that gave startup money to a little over 50% of the nation's startups in the last few years.
Okay.
So they were very heavily focused, not only in technology and life science, but in the startup companies in that area.
So, you know, and I'll give credit where credit is due to Cal Penn hosting The Daily Show this week. So it's basically, if you had an idea to be the Uber of fill in the blank,
mm-hmm.
yep. you'd head on over to SVB.
Exactly. Exactly. Because they were the ones who were basically matching up the idea guys with the money guys.
Okay.
So big stuff through there. And you know, basically, we see very similar niche issues with the other two that quote unquote failed in the last week. Silvergate. Again, the way they describe themselves as Silvergate Bank has served entrepreneurs in unique and niche industries for over 20 years, recognizing digital currency's potential, and that's the big key here.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. During the sector's infancy, we built strong relationships with pioneers who were turned away by traditional banks. Silvergate was one of the largest backers of FTX.
And we know how that worked out.
Yes. Yeah. So Silvergate, as a domino in the FTX world, was actually expected to fall.
Okay.
Very, very much expected to fall there. And in terms of actual size, Silvergate as a company, as a bank, remember that Silicon Valley had about $211 billion in deposits. Signature had about $114 billion in deposits. Silvergate had 11.
Okay.
$11 billion. So it's not even a tenth the size of Signature Bank. So again, small bank, big headlines, right? Because, yeah. Anytime a bank goes, you know, belly up, it's big headlines. But ultimately, I almost want to say not such a big loss.
Yeah, and especially knowing kind of, you know, who they were partnered up with and who they were really, you know, in bed with. You know, you see, you know, dealing a lot with FTX, their issues as well. Obviously, that's going to, as you mentioned, have that domino effect.
Exactly. And then we get that third bank, right? Signature Bank. They call themselves a full-service commercial bank with private client offices throughout New York, Connecticut, North Carolina, and California.
That's a region.
Yeah, that's a region. But here's the niche, right? We focus on serving the financial needs of privately owned business, their owners, and their senior managers, a group of clients who find themselves underserved by their area's larger financial institutions.
Huh.
Now, with that, they actually had a fairly large part of their business that dealt with commercial real estate and, wait for it, digital assets. So once again, we have a bank dealing in large part in the cryptocurrency digital asset world who the FDIC was kind of afraid these guys weren't going to be able to pay their bills because of the dominoes now on that banking side starting to fall.
Yeah, and then how does Credit Suisse fix into this whole issue?
So the short version, and this is the crazy part, is it actually doesn't. Credit Suisse as a bank, right, not part of the American banking system, actually based, as the name would suggest, in Switzerland. But they have a number of backers throughout Europe and the Middle East. And in particular, their largest backer is the Bank of Saudi Arabia, right? So the Saudis looked at what was going on with Credit Suisse and said, we're not going to save you anymore because you keep making bad choices. Now, the crazy part about that is that this is something that our industry has seen coming. They've seen it coming. It's coming down the line. In fact, yesterday on Tuesday, I was actually on a conference call with an analyst in the financial sector who said, without being prompted, just wait. Credit Suisse is coming next, whether that's in the next day, the next week, the next couple of weeks. Credit Suisse is going to be the next one to fall. And the question then becomes, well, how do you know it's the next one to fall? Because the news is already out there, so this is not going to be ground-shaking when something bad happens with Credit Suisse.
Yeah, and really looking at that news cycle, is it uncommon to have four institutions like this have, you know, failures and kind of all have these similar things going on around that same time period? Or is this just something that one day it gets a lot of headlines because it's tied to Silicon Valley or crypto or what have you, and it's kind of getting magnified now just because of that attention?
So the short version is a little bit of yes in there. Yes, there's going to be some extra attention because two of the banks were very crypto heavy. One of them is tied to the tech startup world. So that's going to generate headlines. The other part is that once one bank starts to fail, we can see, I know the news outlets refer to it as a contagion, right? So that this one then fail as well. The reality of it is, though, if you go back to the last time that we saw multiple banks going down in a short amount of time, we're talking 2007, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns. What was the common piece with those two banks? They were very much working their business, selling off those loan packages, the MBS, the mortgage-backed securities that we've talked about before, and selling off the higher risk ones with the low risk ones and going into default, really, and having that happen. So they were working similar issues that all came to a head at the same time, again, in a very narrow niche sort of thing. They weren't just looking and serving the common man. You and I could not have had an account at Bear Stearns or at Lehman Brothers.
Yeah.
It's not like our local bank where anybody can go in. It's not even like the large national ones. These were all regional and very specific to what they served.
Yeah, and there's a lot to talk about as far as what is happening with this and the whole banking future, really these protections that we're starting to learn more about. We're going to talk about that as we continue here on Money Matters.
Are you worried about what's been going on in the markets and how it has affected your portfolio? Maybe you need a financial checkup. If you have questions about the health of your financial future, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary checkup. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC.
Welcome back from that break, ladies and gentlemen. Rick Stevens with you here on Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group in studio with Andrew Rogers. And we're talking about the bank world, Andrew.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussions. We kind of spent that first segment talking about the headlines, what's happening. But let's dig into kind of just the overall topic real quick and what happens when a bank fails. Because really, banks, you know, when you look at their marketing, kind of that, you know, emotional field, they're built on stability, the people you can trust. They've got your back. Obviously, they're holding everything that you hold near and dear. But what happens when they just can't anymore?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? We hear the term bank failure. And oftentimes, we sort of each have our own individual mindset, connotation about what a bank failure should be. Oftentimes, it might even be from what we learned in history, mm-hmm. right? The bank runs that happened in the late 20s and early 30s going into the Depression and, you know, the banks just having to shut down. Or we think about It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Yeah.
The Bailey Savings and Loan, and we've got to close up shop because we can't get money back to our depositors. They want their money. We can't give it to them. And that's kind of in a nutshell what a bank failure is that the bank, believe it or not, doesn't keep everybody's cash literally on hand.
What?
Exactly. They don't have everybody's cash just sitting in a vault. A lot of the cash is literally on paper, mm-hmm. right? Or if we are talking about the 21st century, it's on the computer. It's the zeros and ones. It's tracked digitally. But when you have a number of people who are coming in requesting to have their money pulled out, the bank actually owns assets.
Okay.
Oftentimes, they hold, whether those are short-term or long-term treasury bills or treasury bonds, they hold those assets. Again, they've taken some of their own money, invested it, trying to grow it, because if I can buy a treasury bill and I can have it grow at 4%, I've basically taken my depositors' money that I'm giving them a tenth of a percent on, I can pay it back and still make money in my world.
Okay, so it seems like a little bit of a shell game, a little, you know, three-card Monty, kind of chase the queen.
Right.
But there's been a lot of talk about failure. Also, another term that has been bound about, you put in the show notes here, and is it the same thing? What is this whole receivership thing, and how does that kind of translate between receivership versus failure versus shut doors, insolvency, all these big terms?
Yep. So the concept of receivership actually comes out of a bank failing to be able to give its customers okay. their money. So when that happens, the FDIC, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, so you see the signs in the bank, FDIC insured, mm-hmm. FDIC is the organization, and they basically supply insurance to banks to say, if there's something crazy that goes on, we will insure up to $250,000 per client, per account, that they can get their money out. And we've got the cash
okay.
on hand to be able to take care of that. But if a bank fails, if that happens, the FDIC jumps into two separate roles.
Okay.
One, it is as the insurer of those deposits, right? And they actually say, that's it. We've got the money. You can actually get this much back out. The second part, we hear that receivership, well, the FDIC, in the case of the banks that have failed most recently, has become the receiver of those banks. Now, it's not always that. In fact, over the weekend, last weekend, they tried to sell Silicon Valley Bank. They tried to sell Signature Bank, but there are actually rules
okay.
around that. The first rule of which is that the four largest banks in the country cannot purchase those banks. So that came out of the Dodd-Frank reorganization, I guess, if you will, back in the late 2000s. as some of the new regulations. So the top four banks weren't allowed to bid on being able to take control over SVB, over Signature, take care of those clients. So they opened it up to everybody else, and nobody else wanted to bid on them.
Okay.
So the FDIC received the failed bank, meaning that they are now in charge of those accounts, those assets. And what they are eventually going to do is they're going to start selling off those assets. They're going to start selling off all of the securities that the bank owned, not what the depositors owned through the bank, but what the bank itself owned. So if the bank owned stock in other companies, that's those shares of stock get sold off. If the bank owned shares in itself, because their companies, a lot of companies own shares in themselves, and that's a whole nother show on the stock buyback concepts. Those shares get sold off. Any of the notes, any of the bonds that the bank owned, those get sold off. Now, typically speaking, all of these are going to get sold off at a loss.
Yeah.
Because obviously the bank owned shares in itself, the bank failed, so those shares are not worth much, but you're going to sell those off. If you sell your bond early, right, you didn't hold it for the 2 or 5 or 10 or 30 years that you've got that bond for, you have to sell it at a discount, which means that you might get 95 cents on the dollar or 90 cents on the dollar or 80 cents on the dollar because somebody else is going to buy it so they can get all of that income out of it from the interest. So you've got to sell that off, and ultimately you're taking a loss on these assets overall, but the idea is you're going to do that so that you can make these people whole, the depositors.
Yeah, and once they come in, it's their job to get as much money received and recovered to make those depositors as whole as possible. But when it comes to that FDIC insurance, you'd mentioned that number of $250,000.
Yes.
And especially in these cases where it's a lot of, you know, tech startups, venture capitalists, Signature Bank sounds like you have to have a Rolls Royce even to get into the parking lot.
I think so.
What happens in a lot of these cases where there's probably more than $250,000 in that account?
Well, typically speaking, and I can only go by what the rules are, and then we're going to talk about what the FDIC maybe adjusted in their world. So the rules themselves are $250,000per depositor, per bank, for each particular ownership category. Now, what that means, though, is you've got your own individual account. That's $250,000. If you have a joint account with someone, you're each $250,000. So that could be $500,000 total.
Okay.
You have an LLC or an S-Corp. That has $250,000 available. And you can actually do this to the point where the total maximum insurance allowed by FDIC for an individual, again, based on having different types of accounts in different banks with different ownership structures, you could actually end up with about $1.25 million in what you're insured for.
Okay.
Now, the crazy part is the most recent number that I have seen was that Silicon Valley Bank had over 93% of its accounts that were not insured, meaning they were well above that $250,000 insurance range.
Yeah, and as we were talking about earlier, that even includes, you know, some pretty big name companies and some pretty large accounts that may have some more trickle down effect.
Exactly. One of the larger accounts that they held was actually from Roku, and you know that's a name I'm sure many of us are familiar with. Some of them may even have that in our homes. Roku had about $480 million with Silicon Valley Bank. Now it sounds like a massive number, right? And for normal human beings, it is.
Yeah.
But a lot of these companies, a lot of these startups, a lot of these tech companies that even, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years into it still had money at Silicon Valley Bank. But a lot of that were for paying bills and for making payroll.
Yeah.
And that's where the federal government and the FDIC has stepped in to say, you know what? We're actually going to make all of these depositors completely whole.
Okay.
So we are bypassing that $250,000 limit to make sure Everybody's got money. They've got it available. And they actually did that on Monday of this past week so that those who, if we talk about that trickle-down part, so that those who needed a paycheck could actually get paid.
Yeah. How common is that then for the FDIC to come in and say, we're going to go above and beyond and make sure that everything is whole versus the kind of standard insured rate?
Well, considering that FDIC has been around for, you know, ballpark 100 years, this was the first time they've ever done that. So it is not a common occurrence. And that's one of those other pieces, right? Because now this from the FDIC side of things kind of sets a precedent that, you know what, it's not $250,000. If you're an employer, we're going to insure your entire account because we want people paid.
You know, this sounds a lot like another term we heard back in 2007, 2008, that now instead of some institutions, but there might be some account holders that are too big to fail.
I would love to make that list one day as an account holder that was too big to fail.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that at this point in life, I am nowhere near that. But maybe someday. But you got to play the lottery first, and I don't do that.
No. But, I mean, as we're rolling up here towards the end of this segment, there's a lot of talk then about, you know, the FDIC coming in. So you'd mentioned some of them can sell. Obviously, the market for some of these niche banks simply wasn't there, or else it would have been taken over before it became, you know, Uncle Sam Bank instead of Silicon Valley Bank. So what happens then? Is the FDIC just going to make sure everyone's whole and then eventually move out? Or is this something where now there's some that are just going to be ran by the FDIC in perpetuity?
So the idea is that at some point the FDIC steps away totally. On one of my calls the other day, the initial thought now, because nobody bought them over the weekend, is that they're going to start parceling out different portions of each of those banks and selling off the pieces. So it could be something like a JP Morgan Chase says, we'll take care of all of the savings accounts that were there. And Wells Fargo says, you know what, we will service all of the mortgages that were there. And they're just going to start sort of piecemealing that out to other banks so that, you know, yesterday you were, well, probably not yesterday, last week you were a Silicon Valley Bank depositor, but now your deposits are in, you know, First National Bank of California or something like that.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of times where, you know, especially in these cases, it seems like it's, you know, not really impacting, you know, the everyday person. But from that everyday person perspective, say there was a local bank here that went through that process, FDIC came in, what then happens, you know, as far as the consumer level point? Is there any, you know, delay as far as being able to access things as that transition happens, or is it pretty seamless?
I'm going to give you Evan's answer, and that's the it depends sort of variety
I'm
here.
I'm pretty good at eliciting that these days.
You're good there. Back in 2007 and 8, it took, you know, months to unwind what was going on at Lehman Brothers and at Bear Stearns, months and months and months to do that. Now we saw it happen over a weekend.
Okay.
So the FDIC's intent seems to be we want to make the money available as quickly as humanly possible and take care of these depositors fast so that you want to take it out, you want to move it to a totally different bank that you also know, okay, you come in on Monday, your money is available Monday. You come in Tuesday, your money's available Tuesday. We'll make the transaction happen.
Okay.
So little crazy there, little change over the last decade and a half, but I think there's some good things there from that from that typical consumer side. Folks, we are up against that next break in the show. When we come back, we will continue talking about what's going on, what does it look like, and, well, how does it affect me? So stick around. We will be right back.
Money affects each of us in different ways. Sometimes it's a source of stress and fear. Sometimes it's a source of comfort and security. Whatever your perspective, it's always good to get a second set of eyes on your finances to help serve as a guide. If you are looking for that guidance, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary appointment. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group. Rick Stevens here in studio with Andrew Rogers. And Andrew, we're just trying to make sense of everything going on in the banking world these days because there's some craziness.
Yeah, there's a lot of headlines and it seems like it's becoming pretty, you know, quick in, you know, we hear about one, then another. And it seems like if you're really just focusing on the headlines or, you know, the people with the buttons or flashing lights that, you know, hey, is the sky falling? Do I need to get my umbrella? But really, let's take a look at what actually happened and try to make some sense over everything that's been going on with these banking issues.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is that even inside each of the three banks that we've seen up to the recording of the show basically fold up and get taken over by the FDIC, each one is a little bit different in whether or not people saw this coming. So, for example, Silvergate. Silvergate, as a bank, had been struggling for months on end. In January of this past year, so January 2023, they actually laid off 40% of their workforce. So to see them fold by March wasn't a very big stretch, right? In fourth quarter last year, so October through December of 2022, they actually reported almost $1 billion in a net loss for that fourth quarter. And part of that was because last year we saw basically a rush to the exits, if you will, because remember, Silvergate had that niche market serving the cryptocurrency world. Last year, we saw the problems with FTX and them basically imploding. Well, by the end of last year, the deposits at Silvergate were down 68%. So they were actually, they started as an $11 billion bank. By the end of last year, they had $3.8 billion.
So that kind of was like a mini instance of what we saw back in the 20s then, where we saw it start off with some, in, you know, with a little bit of maybe fear, some uncertainty when it comes to what they were investing in, and there was a run on that bank to get out while the getting was good.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, for Silvergate, last year they actually sold off $5.2 billion of what, you know, in the industry we call debt securities. Basically, they took a $5.2 billion loan is what they did. They created a bond, sold it off. Then they went to the Federal Home Loan Bank and asked for an additional $4.3 billion. And that loan started to get the attention of folks in Washington, D.C., in particular, Elizabeth Warren, who basically was looking at this going, okay, because of what these guys have done, and we saw what happened with FTX collapsing, this is actually introducing even more risk into the traditional banking system.
Yeah, but here's my question with that. Doing this quick math, they're looking for basically loans and backing of, what, $9.5 billion, but yet their deposits were under four. So they're asking for twice as much as they actually had customer deposits. So what does that other four and a half really cover, and what were they trying to get?
So the idea there is sort of the, we're looking to continue to grow. If we can prove that we are solvent, meaning we have enough money in-house to take care of our depositors, more depositors will come back in. So as I can start to show that I have enough to cover what people might want to withdraw, I can maybe get back up to that 8, 9, 10, even to the 11 billion mark that I was at previously.
So it's at that point, they were going to the other home loan, or the Federal Home Loan Bank, they were going to sell off some securities and essentially trying to rob Peter to pay Paul.
Exactly. Exactly. It's that idea of, you know what, I'm going to take out a second mortgage on my house to go get X, Y, and Z. I'm just going to go into more debt to pay off this loan or that loan.
Yeah, so, I'm having trouble paying my mortgage, so right. I'm going to get a second mortgage to try and get some capital to help pay the first mortgage.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a concept that is age old, and even in that age old concept has never actually worked.
Yeah.
It's amazing how these things kind of come back cyclically.
Yeah.
Right? Time over time.
So then, you know, we saw that, and we see, you know, some investment firms with some curious names who've been involved with a lot of recent discussions.
Yes.
Citadel Securities, BlackRock, now jumping in to invest in this. So, I mean, how does that play a role in the ultimate demise of Silvergate?
So the actual role there is that they were buying securities that Silvergate owned in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So Silvergate is selling their own securities, again, trying to raise some capital. These two large investment management firms said, you know what, we will take the risk because we think it's going to, you know, you guys are going to be just fine. And so Citadel had bought about 5.5% of the stock available in Silvergate there. BlackRock bought about 7%, and just like everything else, there are risks when you are investing. Even if you are that giant asset manager like BlackRock, there are risks, and they need to be weighed.
Yeah. Well, were they trying to think that this could become the next, you know, AMC or something like that, where they're trying to get into these risky things, trying to bet short positions on it?
So it sounds like a huge amount
in
our world, right? 5.5%, 7%, so a little over 12.5% of the company was bought by these two firms. However, the stock price was way down. From that investment management side, this is a terribly, terribly small portion of their overall investments throughout, you know, hundreds of different firms inside their dozens of different mutual funds. So ultimately, we're talking about investments that were probably, in the grand scheme, less than 0.5% of their overall holdings in general.
So kind of, you know, the penny slots, if you will, for these
right.
kind of guys.
Exactly. You know, it's the, hey, if this kicks straight up, we come out as winners. If it goes away, well, it didn't cost us much to lose it.
Yeah. Then looking at the other big one, SVB, what really, you know, went into that and that kind of demise, because it's similar but yet still totally different.
Right. So with SVB, we actually see what you would almost call a perfect storm.
Okay.
Right? Because if you look at their investments over time, their investments grew exponentially in 2020 and 2021. Now, can you think of anything that happened in 2020 and 2021 where businesses may have gotten a large influx of capital and needed somewhere to put it?
I wonder.
There may have been a little pandemic money.
Yeah, a little stimmy, as they would say on the streets.
Yes, there you go. There you go. So what actually happened was, at one point over that two-year time frame, the deposits in Silicon Valley Bank went up by $60 billion, with a B, billion dollars, because of stimulus money coming in. So there were those deposits coming in, and SVB, like most banks, actually took that and bought U.S. Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities.
Okay.
The problem with SVB is that the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates. So what they bought at 1 and 2 and 3% were now available at 4 and 5 and 6%. But because they bought long duration, right? They bought 30-year bonds. They were going to have to take a big loss if they sold those and tried to buy the new higher valued ones with the higher interest rates, and they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
They couldn't do it anymore.
And then another big headline that we've started to see, especially kind of throughout that first quarter of 23 now, especially knowing that they were in Silicon Valley, the heart of the tech sector, is a lot of those big tech companies realized, hey, we probably were adding on employees and getting people in at a heavy, heavy pace, probably too heavy. So then that started those tech layoffs, and that just kind of added into the perfect storm you were talking about.
Exactly. You know, if you look at what has gone on in the technology industry, really in the last 5 to 10 years, but the last 5 years in particular, coming into 2023, tech companies had massive hirings going on, bringing in people. And all of a sudden, after everybody else was no longer working at home, but was actually going into the office to work, there were a lot of pieces of technology they didn't need anymore. So revenue streams started to dry up. Uh-oh, the last 5 years we've actually overhired, so now we have to have some layoffs going on. We have to, as some folks in the industry would call it, right-size the company. And we've seen it, right? Apple did it. Microsoft has done it. Amazon has done it. There are companies out there laying off people.
Yeah.
5%, 10%, 20%. So as the tech companies are laying more and more folks off, they need to also withdraw more and more funds from Silicon Valley Bank because we're paying operating expenses, but we don't have operating revenue coming in. So it's kind of like saying, you know what? I get in my paycheck, I get $1,500 that comes in, but my bills are $2,000. I've got to get that $500 for somewhere. So hopefully I've got it in my savings account. Well, add 3 or 4 or 5 more zeros to that per week for your tech companies.
Yeah, not to mention too, as you mentioned, this was a lot of, you know, the, you know, banks where venture capitalists would invest into funds. So then to get rid of some of these clients, there were stock payouts, things like that. So it just kind of added into that, you know, more going out than coming in.
Yeah, and ultimately what ended up happening is to try to basically stay open, to start taking advantage, if they could, of some of those interest rate increases. Silicon Valley Bank had to sell off assets, and they actually created $1.8 billion in loss to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know about where you come from. I mean, you know, you got the Michigan-Detroit thing going on. But where I grew up, $1.8 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah, and of course, you know, but you always hear that, you know, for some businesses and things like that, showing a loss is a good thing on paper because, again, it's all theoretical. It all goes back to the statistics you started with, that if you can, you know, kind of do the books however you want, statistics can show whatever you want it to say. But really, this kind of a loss is a loss no matter what way you cut it.
Yeah, this was a hard line loss. This wasn't just I'm making up a loss on paper to not pay taxes. This was, we've lost a lot of money. And that kind of rolls into with what happened at Signature Bank. Because that sudden collapse, if you will, of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank customers got a little worried. And they basically withdrew about $10 billion or 10% of those total deposits that were in Signature Bank on Friday, last week. So that run on deposits basically set off all the flags for the regulators to say, hey, we're going to make sure the depositors are taken care of. That's it. You guys are out. We're taking over. We are going to receive the bank. So that's basically what they did. Sort of a preemptive, if you will, receivership on Signature, not waiting for a failure to happen, but saying, hey, we think this is about to fail. We're just going to take it now.
Yeah, it's interesting to see exactly what happens. And Rick, we're coming up on the end of the break, but there's still that big question, the big thing that's kind of circled for everyone's mind. And I think if you've heard a lot of what we've talked about, you probably already know the answer. But again, there's also the talking heads. We're sitting here recording the TV we have over here on mute in the corner of the studio, talking about it nonstop in that last segment with a lot of, you know, their little lower third saying one thing. Don't really know what the senator they had on was saying, but we're going to break down what that means to us still ahead right here on Money Matters.
Does stock market volatility have you wondering which way is up? Do the talking heads and doomsayers have you wondering if this really is the end? If you want straight answers from an advisor who isn't just trying to sell you something, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary appointment today. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO. Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC.
Folks, thanks for sticking with us through that break on Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group. Rick Stevens here in studio with Andrew Rogers. We're trying to eliminate a lot of the emotion, Andrew, that we have seen, that we have heard as the concept comes out. Oh my goodness, banks are failing. Right? We're trying to alleviate some of that that worry, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So I guess the big question and a lot of questions on a lot of people's minds is, if this can happen there, is my bank okay? Is my bank safe?
You know, we were talking about statistics earlier. And, you know, again, as a baseball guy, I love statistics. You can not only make them say anything, but you can actually make really good decisions based on them. I know if I've got a guy and this is his third at bat in the game and he hasn't hit a curveball all game, it's probably best to not throw him one now because he's probably looking for it. And we're going to adjust those pitches accordingly. So the statistics can help me win in that scenario. And quite frankly, from those statistics, right, the question, is my bank okay? Statistically speaking, it's probably going to be just fine.
Okay.
Because most of us are not banking at that very specialized niche bank. Most of us, I'm going to go out on a limb. I think this is probably going to cover the bulk of our listeners, but most of us don't have more than the $250,000 FDIC insurable amount in our accounts. So for the most part, we are going to be very safe.
Okay.
And your money's going to be available. Your bank has cash on the books, not on hand, but on the books, mm-hmm. right? Written down that it can use to give you that withdrawal, to honor a check that you've written, to pay for whatever it is that you swiped your debit card with. Your banks are going to be fine. Now, I know we like to blow it up and, oh my goodness, the sky is falling. That's not the case. This is not, you know, you may have heard the term systematic, right? This is not a systemic or a systematic issue. It's not the whole banking system that has a problem. It's a couple of very specific regional banks. And even looking at in the big picture, if you look at what happened to the stock prices of banks last week, right? Friday last week when all this is coming out, even into Monday, Tuesday of this week. If you looked at the regional banks, there were some regional banks who had nothing to do with any of this, but their stock values were down 60 and 70% versus your larger banks like Citigroup, like JP Morgan, like Wells Fargo, that may have been down 3 or 4% because, yes, everybody was down, but they weren't down nearly as much.
Yeah, so when it comes to those questions and when it comes to, you know, that peace of mind, because again, you turn on an advertisement, the bank comes on, it's a nice shiny day of a family sitting there in a park swinging or a lovely home, things like that, really making you feel secure.
It's got to be a brick home, by the way. It's always a brick home.
Absolutely, because it's that sense of, you know, firm foundation, and the bank's supposed to give you security. If you are curious, you know, what should you be looking for, whether it be on the bank's website, in the branch office, to make sure that you are somewhere that is stable?
Well, there are actually a lot of different places that you can go. You can find out things if you just search the bank's stock ticker.
Okay.
In fact, you can find out a lot of different pieces of information through there. One of those things that I always tell folks is a good thing to be able to look at, and it's one of those problems, actually, that the Silicon Valley Bank had as an issue, right? 93% of their depositors were not actually covered by the FDIC, even though they're going to be covered by the FDIC. The average bank has about 51% of its depositors with accounts that are less than $250,000. So that's one big thing to look at, right? Is how solvent, I guess, one way to look at that, how solvent is my bank? The other thing you want to look at is, does my bank say that they specialize in serving one specific niche market.
Okay.
Because oftentimes, right, we've heard about that concept of, I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket. Well, if your bank mostly services a very specialized niche market, your bank has put all of their eggs in one basket. And when something goes wrong for that particular sector of the economy, your bank may have issues.
Yeah.
So just take a look. Take a look on the bank's website to see what kind of accounts do they offer. Do they offer checking and savings accounts for individual? Do they offer joint accounts for you and somebody else? Do they offer checking and savings for businesses? Do they offer CDs? Do they offer money market accounts? Do they have a very wide array of different types of accounts that they can offer to people? Because typically, if they do, they actually have a very diverse customer base, and they're not dependent on just one particular type of customer to really back the whole business that they've got.
Yeah, and Rick, this may be, just putting it frankly, this might be a dumb question.
Nah, but a lot of people
use the term bank very loosely, but is there any specifics when it comes to, say, what's going on in this sector versus, you know, protections or whatever when it comes to a credit union? Because I know a lot of people also use that as their typical banking system, using more that verb term versus right. The actual way the institution is structured.
So the short version is sort of. The one thing different between a credit union and a typical bank, right? Your bank is considered a business.
Okay.
And as I have gone in and made a deposit in the bank, I am the customer. In a credit union, when I go in and I make a deposit in my credit union, I'm now one of the owners of that. And for those folks that have been part of those local credit unions, oftentimes at the end of a year, you'll actually see that credit union put a little extra, you know, some kind of a bonus in your account because they made X amount in profits. Those profits then get split amongst the shareholders, which anybody who has money at that credit union is a shareholder. So everybody gets X amount put back into their account. So it's a little different in the ownership side.
Okay. Yeah, because I know, especially when it comes to those credit unions, they're very, you know, hyper-regional, very hyper-localized. So that was the question. And then also, when it comes to, you know, all the protections, as we talked about, what the FDIC does when it comes to your actual account, checking, savings, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
What about the investment accounts as well? Is there any protections for that?
So again, this is something that actually came out of what was going on in 2007, 2008. So some of those new rules, regulations, one of the things that was created is what's called the SIPC.
Okay.
So that's the securities industry version of the FDIC. And there are certain things that SIPC actually does to insure. Now, you got to remember, it's an investment. Okay, so there is the possibility for the up and the down in the price, in the value of that investment. So SIPC does not protect market loss. It does not protect investments if a firm is not an SIPC member. It does not protect any promises on performance. It does not protect commodities because commodities are actually separately governed. They're not part of the securities industry. It doesn't cover future contracts because, again, futures are not part of the securities world. They're part of a different industry. But there are things that they do protect, not the least of which is if you have money in your brokerage account, if that broker goes away, just like the bank goes away, SIPC will actually guarantee that you can get your money out, right? So if you have things that are in a cash account, you can get that money back. If you hold securities through a brokerage firm, so whether that is a stock, a bond, a mutual fund, whatever, and the broker goes away, so I oftentimes tell folks, think of a broker as the actual bookshelf.
Okay.
And your stocks, your bonds, your mutual funds, those are the books that you put on that bookshelf. If one day that bookshelf disappears, you still have that book And the SIPC says, and we'll help you take care of that. We'll sell it for you to get you the cash. We will help you to buy more in the event that you want to buy more. We'll help you continue doing what you're doing. Your investments don't just disappear if your broker does.
Yeah, and when we asked a similar question about your bank, your financial institution, about making sure that they have those protections, when it comes to finding that broker, that financial advisor making those investments, how do you ensure that they have all those protections from the SIPC and whatnot?
So just like at a bank, when you walk into wherever your advisor is or the broker, they should have a sign out front, right? Banks have the sign out front that says FDIC. Oftentimes you even see these at the teller desks. When you walk into an advisor's office, out front, displayed prominently, if they are an SIPC member, is supposed to be the SIPC sign. So that's the I'm physically walking in. If I'm not physically walking in, you can typically go to their website. And at the bottom of that website, it will say, typically, member FINRA/SIPC. So FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and the SIPC, the insurance side, having backed up the brokerage and you being able to continue to do your business, even if the broker doesn't do theirs.
So that should be the first, maybe red flag if you're looking for an investment firm, if you're looking for a brokerage, that they don't have that kind of language either somewhere posted in their office or on their website.
Exactly. Or in the disclaimer at the beginning of their show.
Okay.
So
or at the end of a commercial or anything like that.
Right, all of those different pieces, right? Because those are the folks who actually regulate what we can and what we can't say, what we do, what we promise or don't promise, right? Because one of those things that in my world is SIPC does not protect the promise of investment performance. If I, as an advisor, were to make a promise, this, I guarantee, is going to do XYZ, I personally am on the hook for that to happen. So we cannot guarantee, we cannot do any of those pieces because that's not governed by the SIPC.
Which is why you typically hear on a lot of these, disclaimers and the fast talk at the end of a lot of these products is, past results, not an indication of future, blah, 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 blah.
Exactly. When we're on that advisor side, we can look at the past to see how things have responded in certain economic times, and we can make a prediction moving forward with a certain amount of it should be in range X to Y. And rarely will you hear somebody say, in January, this particular investment is going to do ABC.
Yeah.
No. But what you often hear is, over the next 5 years, if conditions remain the same, we can expect this range, or in the next 10, or in the next 20. And that's why guys like Dave Ramsey talk about finding that good growth stock mutual fund, forgetting that you own it, because look for the 10-year track record. Here's what the market has done in that 10-year period. Here's how this fund behaved in that same 10-year period. So we can expect that as the market does XYZ, the fund should behave this way.
Absolutely.
So a lot of different pieces through there. If there are folks out there who still have questions, because again, it's only Wednesday when we're doing the recording. There could be more stuff happen before Saturday when we air. Folks, if you've got questions, if you're not sure what's going on, how you're affected, what in the world does it all mean, you can feel free to give me a call at 719-500-8700. I am happy to sit down to kind of go over what's been going on, what that outlook might be for you in particular, things that you might need to do to make some adjustments. Well, we will be back again next week on Money Matters, continuing to talk about your money because your money matters. Tune in next week, everybody.